Hello, and welcome to episode 438 of the Creating Crowbar, a gaming podcast being recorded on the 8th of October, 2024. I'm the Spectre of Decay, the summer's baleful executioner, a herald of frozen death made of twigs and leaves, otherwise known as Marsh Davis, and emerging from their burrows to collect the season's final fleeting bounty of nuts and berries are Jamie Britton.
Hello.
And Tom Senior.
Hello.
Welcome to autumn, gentlemen. Have you bobbed any apples or roasted any chestnuts or wilted into a puddle of rot and mould?
Lots of rot and mould where I live in Froome, which is a lovely little small town that is just being inevitably reclaimed by nature. All the walls are just being infiltrated by roots. And now they're all dying and rotting, and there's this kind of sludge coming out of, coming in, encroaching on the outside of the city. So whenever I go to walk to the shops, it feels like there's some sort of living thing surrounding me. It's quite good. That is, I like it.
That's a more thematically apposite than I thought your response was going to be.
If the sludge of Froome doesn't make it as the title of this episode. I went on a lovely autumnal walk around Paynes Hill Park. Have you guys ever been to Paynes Hill Park?
No.
No, where is it?
It's in Surrey, where I live. And it is a big old park, which the facts of which are escaping me entirely, but it's like a big old park made in, like, I don't know, the 19th century question mark that you can do a walk around. And it costs like 12 quid to get in. And you walk around it with your kids who moan pretty much from the beginning to the end. But it's got a crystal grotto halfway around. You can go inside the crystal grotto and it's a cave with like crystals on the ceiling. And it's a bit magic. I felt a bit magic in there, looking up at the strange formations of crystals.
Yeah, are they real crystals that have grown in a natural way, or have they been like planted in an artificial ceiling?
You know, there was like several like plaques around there, which would explain exactly how those crystals had formed, had they formed at all. I didn't read any of them. I was chasing children around. this is a thing you get with kids. Like, you have to just like end up just understanding things on a really basic level whenever you go to a museum or a attraction or anything, because the kids just move so fast that you can never take in any information. So there's Brooklyn's like museum of like air and transport and cars and stuff, and you can get on the planes, right? They've got these big planes parked outside that you can go and have a look around. And they're completely insane, right? Because they're like, this plane was donated by some crazed like Saudi Arabian like minor royal family member to Brooklyn's museum in 1978. And you can go and get in the cockpit. And it's kind of fascinating and insane. But yeah, with kids, you never get to internalize anything. You just, life just passes you by one boring family-friendly attraction at a time. But yeah, Paynes Hill Park, recommended. 8 out of 10 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Tom.
Hello.
Have you been playing a game recently?
I have. Given that it's spooky season, we've just heading into October, and obviously beautiful autumnal tones all around us, I thought I'd dip some ghosty, lovely ghostiness in Alan Wake 2, which has been out for a little while, and is the latest one from Remedy of Max Payne fame, and then Alan Wake fame, and then Control fame, and now this. And this is the latest in their attempt to create...
Don't forget Quantum Break.
Yes, of course.
Which obviously changed media forever by using television and video game.
That was, I believe that was a Microsoft partnership where they were... It's been attempted a few times, this thing where you try to run a game alongside a television series. And the idea is that one influences the other, and it never, ever actually works at all. There's an MMO that tried to do it called Tabula Rasa, I think.
What about that Silent Hill game from last year where people could watching at home could vote on how things were going to go, and everyone was like, it's going to be great. It's not going to be terrible. It's definitely not going to be terrible, this Silent Hill game that you can vote on the outcome.
The trouble is, though, there's not much like I can think of that's less scary than a vote. Democracy, the act of democracy is perhaps not the sort of like the tense sort of mechanic that you want to drive your drama forwards, really. Especially like if it's, you know, do you want this character to go left or right? It's a bit like the games like Until Dawn and those games where you have these very binary decisions. And it's better off, you're better off watching a film, aren't you, really? making sure that no other humans are involved. But yes, Alan Wake 2 from Remedy. It's absolute catnip for games critics, this whole series. Because, of course, you know, as we know, all games critics are cats, so it's just only natural. And the reason is it's kind of created this self-referential meta narrative that exists across all of Remedy's games. And they star, like, Sam Lake is one of, I think, the creative director at Remedy, and he's just in their games and has written most of them. And he's indeed in this one as well, in live-action kind of parody cutscenes and television programs that appear in-world as you're exploring the universe, in which the writer Alan Wake is trapped and tormented in a story, a nightmarish story of his own making. And his writing is changing reality in extremely, you know, very Garth Marenghi kind of level twist. So Garth Marenghi, I don't know if it's quite a niche reference, but it's kind of a parody of Stephen King, basically. Fantastic. Look it up on, there's about to be stuff on YouTube if you've missed out on Garth Marenghi. It's very funny. So yeah, you've got the kind of Stephen King character who's trapped in an evil, dark realm, right, trying to write his way out and accidentally screwing up reality as he's doing this. And he's, as a character, quite irritating and just kind of very angsty. The whole kind of shtick is kind of so played out within the confines of the first game, let alone the second game, that it's a huge relief that actually for at least half of the game you play as someone else completely. An FBI agent called Saga, who kind of interacts with Wake during moments of overlap where his reality overlaps with conventional reality, and you get lots of monsters appearing and you have to shoot them in kind of Resident Evil 4 style sequences, very close over the shoulder, third person, point lights at them to burst their kind of evil dark shields and then shoot them in the head many, many times to drop them. And it's about sort of about 50% doing that, going around very dark, very atmospheric woods and old towns, and the rest of
sort
it
of,
is...
moving at a light jog is the kind of pace of that game, is sort of...
Very much so, yeah. Yeah.
Just even going moments, for a morning jog.
Even in moments of great urgency. In fact, you never quite move faster than the very first person you play as, which is you play as a great big naked man who walks out of the lake, and you sort of stumble around being hunted by monsters. And I felt like really happy to be sort of personally represented as by an avatar in the game, and like for the first time. It's like much of the game quite funny, and it goes from FBI procedural to absolute nonsense, kind of the dead walking the earth in about 10 minutes. And it never really kind of stops there. It just keeps on going and getting increasingly ridiculous. But yes, I've been quite enjoying it. And there's a lot to recommend it in terms of some of the technical things that it does. Mixing live action with extremely high fidelity rendered 3D scenes with extraordinary lighting they've got. And some of the most effective moments, they overlay live action scenes with the environment that you're in these overlap moments. So you'll be walking through some woods, and you'll like half of what you're seeing will suddenly like a different reality will phase in around you, and you'll be walking through a subway system or a hall or some place that Alan Wake is in, and vice versa. And those moments are actually really, really well done. And I've tried to sort of stop and move around, and I'm not quite sure how they've done it, because it seems to be rendering a video over the actual 3D environment that you're exploring, but as you're walking through it, it's moving at the same pace and it reacts to you at the same speed as the environment. So you get this really effective mapping of different environments overlaying on one another, like simultaneously. Jamie, you've played it. Is that an accurate description of those moments?
Absolutely. I mean, we did talk about this game last year, I think, when it first came out. I was mostly very annoyed by it. But it is a game I think about a lot. I mean, on the really good side of things, I think one of the things that Remedy have done with Alan Wake 2 in particular, but it's also something they've been kind of tickling around with for quite a long time now, is making it okay to mix video and digital versions of the same characters, locations, things like that. It's always felt icky when it's been done before, and it mostly just hasn't been done before. Like, you might get something that's full-blown FMV, you know, your Sam Barlow games, like carrying the torch for that. Or you'll get something that is very, very detailed representations of reality. But mixing the two, I think, is just, it's done brilliantly in Alan Wake 2. And I think there's something that's happened where that kind of uncanny valley has been made less deep by the fact that the digital simulacrums of human faces, for example, are so good now that you can see an image of the dude who plays Alan Wake, who I'm not going to honour by learning that actor's name, but you can see video of that guy and then see him as a digital character, clearly, and those things can feel entirely continuous. And I think that is a real win for them, and something I always sort of, I think we should see more of in like AAA, AA space. I'd certainly like to, because, you know, the stuff that you can do in live action, which is better, right? And if you can move from one to the other, as they do in that game, pretty smoothly, then I think that's just really exciting. You know, they've tried to kind of cross media with their Quantum Break stuff in the past, but actually being less kind of conceptual about it and sort of being more conceptual about it in how they kind of do it, you know, in all their kind of weird reality bending things. I do think they've done some great work for the industry generally in terms of that kind of blend of stuff.
Yeah, I think the facial animations on the 3D models are like spectacularly impressive, especially for even just like spare characters who aren't in the game very much. There's a waitress called Rose in a very Twin Peaks inspired diner who does this very kind of like cheesy Americana of deliberate overacting and a deliberate spooky cheerfulness as she refers to things in your character's past that has never happened to her and that kind of thing. And that is like, that's sold by the digital performance as much as it's sold by the voice acting and the actual kind of real life performance that goes into that. So I'd be fascinated to know how they, I mean, I'm assuming it's like lots of stapling lots of balls to people's faces and getting them to mocap it, but I wonder if there's additional tweaking or if they've just put loads of effort into the face technology that in terms of animating the muscular motions and expressions of faces that just other games haven't particularly concentrated on as much. It's very impressive. It's really, really cool. It's kind of, it's a lot of kind of heavy lifting for something that's otherwise quite silly, is what I would say. So if you're going into expecting like a really authentic or particularly scary thing, it's not like genre defying. It's so obsessed with the genre and that it becomes a kind of self parody, and even while it's trying to be a parody, it's sort of like it becomes too silly. But at the same time, there are like it is creepy because like the lighting is incredible. The sound design is really, really strong, particularly for like the enemies have these kind of garbled half thoughts. They're kind of muttering all the time about leaving pipes uncleaned and just random sort of stuff, like the idle thoughts that occur to them before they were taken by this evil darkness and have become sort of shadowy facsimiles of their former selves. Before you headshot them, obviously, in a sort of like very, again, you know, as the plot borrows so much from like horror fiction and is kind of a cheesy rendition of it, like the actual, but mechanically what you're doing is also a kind of a mashup of other games that have done it better. So it kind of really squashes the amount of ammunition that you have all the time, to the extent that it becomes just a bit too frustrating and annoying, because actually you want to get through the fights pretty quickly to get to the next thing. Enemies are a bit too bullet spongy, and the bosses are a little bit irritating. All those normal things, really. But what is good is that it doesn't, like, unless you go into the optional areas and do a lot of extra side quests and side tasks, you don't have to, like, the combat isn't too much of it, really. It is, like, 40% of the game, 50% tops, I would say. And the rest of it is kind of, like, just chatting to people, having spooky moments. There's lots of kind of flashes in your face if you don't like that sort of thing. So, like, very subtle cuts with, like, angry faces, teeth.
And doing my best to simulate that there. the game does it relentlessly.
The game does it all the time. And if Jamie's outburst there scares you, then this game will mess you up. So that's kind of like, it's actually like a good
the cheapest,
it's like,
cheapest conceivable jump scare.
Yes.
Of just like creepypastering a face in your face every now and then again to keep you on your toes. I kind of got addicted to it by the end. I was sort of enjoying
it. Yeah. I've got to say, sure, I'm enjoying it because I'm imagining them make the actors pull those faces because they're actually like real images of the real actors, like just doing stupid, like evil grins and stuff. And I've just gone through a sequence where the sort of main antagonist is a really creepy old lady, and it looks like she had loads of fun just being evil for that role, which is quite, I'm not sure that was what they were going for. But
I did enjoy the creepy old lady. She was fun.
She's really good. That whole section is quite fun because it just randomly mixes in mythology as well as just as horror movie stuff. So there's some kind of like Norse mythology in there, just because like I think Remedy is kind of Scandinavian developer and Sam Lake, who's I think the main writer, creative director, is Finnish and likes it. it's very much just seems to be a game where the stuff these people like have just gone in it without particularly worrying about whether it all hangs together.
Yeah.
which is bold, given that they're trying to create an extended universe. And they, what do you think, Jamie?
It's bold. I mean, I was, as you can hear on the podcast we recorded about it back then, I was driven half mad by the end of that game because it just started seeming like this relentless game of like consequence where they were just folding over the paper and writing a new thing on it. And then just going on and on into this kind of infinite regress to nothingness. It drove me absolutely up the wall. That's a whole other podcast as it was. But there's so much to love about Remedy. And like the fact that they have these obsessions, I guess it's mostly Sam Lake, but like these obsessions with like Finland and Finnish mythology, which is like great. Like we don't get that anywhere else. Like soft rock.
Loads of music,
but specifically soft rock from, I guess, his mate who has a band. But like some of them have become just beyond parody, like the obsession with Twin Peaks, the obsession with like coffee and all that sort of stuff. That is just, I haven't actually played the DLCs, but I watched a very good video on them. With a YouTuber summarizing them, and once I'd done that, now traditional act of you find a YouTube video on something you like, and then you have to Google the person making it to make sure they're not a toxic monster. And like 45% of the time they're not. And so I watched a video kind of summarizing the DLCs, and I was like, there's another one about to come out, actually. It's coming out any day now, which I'm guessing will, I mean, I was going to say maybe it's going to round off the saga, but I really doubt it. Like, Remedy hate ending stories with any kind of definitive kind of beat like that. So the DLCs kind of continue that that kind of journey onwards. One of the characters in the DLC is that waitress, which is quite good fun. Another one of the characters is the actor Sean Ashmore, who is in the game, right? Yeah, as himself. He's playing Sean Ashmore. And that DLC, which everyone says is the best one, is him going into a kind of multiverse of madness kind of zone, literally as the actor Sean Ashmore, star of X-Men and Quantum Break and Alan Wake. And like, I just can't, even though those games annoy me so much, I just can't get cross with them because no one is doing anything like that with the kind of fidelity and commitment to the bit that Remedy are. It's really something. And like, I'm looking forward to like probably watching a YouTube video about that final DLC that's coming, because
I mean, it's
very, very faint praise, I guess, but still.
What I'm hoping for now is not really an ending, as you say, because it's just, you know, it's kind of, well, if reality is just malleable, anyone could change anything, then nothing really exists or matters. It's kind of, it runs into that problem quite quickly, and it's just, well, there are people who are worried about their family members and who are in sort of jeopardy because the story's been rewritten, but it's kind of, it doesn't land, because like, never does this kid even exist? Does this, you know,
that person... was the damning thing. I was having a shower earlier. I don't need to describe that any more than I just did, but I was having a shower and I was thinking about this podcast, as I often do in the shower, and I was like, what else is there to say about Alan Wake from my perspective after I was so horrible about it before? And the thing I can't get past is the fact that despite all the effort that's gone into it and all the wonderful things that it does, it's very hard to work out how any of the stuff that's happening in it matters. Like, nothing it has to say has any purchase in any real emotions, I think. It feels all very much like sort of psychedelic and bonkers, and it does a really great job of wowing you on that level. But it just doesn't have much humanity to it, ultimately, in a way that, like, Control, I thought, really did. Like, I loved Control, and that has a lot of humanity to it, I think. I'm reading at the moment a book, I think, Marsh, you might have mentioned, I'm reading Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, like, really, really good and is primarily concerned with spiders. And it just reminded me of how, like, crazy bonkers, like, wouldn't it be funny, yeah, ideas that you could kind of come up with stoned can be deeply human and deeply emotional and grounded, despite the fact that they're taking place in these kind of spectacular realms. And I think that's one thing that Alan Wake's lacking a bit of. Yeah.
I think that's really right, especially because, yeah, you're because, like, Control, my biggest hope for Alan Wake 2 is that it sets up Control 2, basically, and gets back to the Control part of the universe a bit faster, because there are agents from the Federal Bureau of Control in, like, explicitly in Alan Wake 2. I think it was one of the DLCs as a character from Control that you play as. So the Federal Bureau of Control is this Federal Bureau which documents these strange occurrences, supernatural occurrences, paranormal activity across the world, and Alan Wake's one of those. And there's a file on him in Control, just as that you sort of find in a random side room. He's just one of millions of these objects and strange events that they're documenting. The great thing about Control is that it's all gone wrong inside their main office, and you meet all the poor employees who have to deal with the absolute nonsense, the fallout, the sort of like bureaucratic and horrifying fallout of these objects being mishandled. So there's a guy who you find in a random room, and he's freaking out because he has to sit there. He's on shift. He has to stare at this fridge. And he's like, he's been there for hours since the disaster happened, and no one's come to relieve him or take him off duty. So he's trying not to blink watching this fridge. And you read like some stuff around the room. It's like something really bad happens if you look away from the fridge and no one else is looking at the fridge. And it doesn't end so well for him. So that's just like you're constantly meeting these people who are in these desperate, oddly human. It's a bit like a Saw film, but more human than that, because they're just ordinary employees desperately trying to sort of muddle through this terrible emergency. And that sense of humor, dark sense of humor, is well directed to Control. Whereas the humor in Alan Wake 2 is like so self-referential, with the kind of the fake chat shows and things like that, and it's TV shows, that it's sending up the form of chat shows, it's sending up the form of horror rather than actually putting humans in it and, you know, representing what they would actually do. So I think, like, I'm not expecting it to get any better at that, but I'd say that this and the other example is actually Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice. Also did a really good job of incorporating like real life FMV with 3D environments, and that was just actually on a relatively low budget, did an amazing pioneering job, I think, in that space as well. And it's something that if I'd like to see more from the industry is trying to do that. Especially, I've been playing lots of, you know, the God of War Ragnarok recently, and that has like meticulously beautifully modeled faces and stuff like that. But there's still, there's not much, it can't be better than seeing a human performance, even if it's not a great one sometimes. I think Alan Wake 2 does prove that to an extent.
It's funny you should mention Hellblade, because a game I played just before this podcast went on its definitely planned hiatus was Senua's Saga, which is, like, I don't want to sit here and, like, slag off a game again, because, like, I've done enough of that today. But it has something in common with Alan Wake, right? In that, like, when you play as Alan in Alan Wake 2 in the dark place, you're basically doing environmental puzzle solving, which basically involves you sort of walking around a environment, focusing on things in a certain order, which will achieve like state changes in that environment and allows you to progress, right? Hellblade Senua's Saga, Hellblade 2, does exactly the same thing. And actually that's the majority of the game, is exploring these kind of environments, lining things up from like perspective puzzles, squeezing. I always imagine them going like when you're like hold down X to focus. And then that opens up a route through. And like Senua's Saga, it's been pretty well established, that game's shortcomings. But I do think it is something that the kind of AA to AAA space has to reckon with in terms of their incredibly high fidelity visuals like that. Because playing both of those games this year, I was so frustrated that was my main verb in those games, was to kind of engage with the environment themselves as a kind of cinematic element. You know, you're basically using cinematics and those special effects as your verbs. I just think it's very hard to get right. There's, you know, games are obviously very good at finding ways to get you to use your perspective in order to change things. But, you know, for me in Senua's Saga, I love the combat, right? The combat where it's like this insane, like really spectacular, really cinematic sequences that are very on rails and are essentially a rock, paper, scissors, but are done with such a level of like brutal detail that it's just fabulous and fantastic. Whereas the environmental puzzles, where I'm kind of, straining to pass a kidney stone whilst looking at a sunset, is, less exciting and less interesting. And Alan Wake does pretty much exactly the same thing. So I'm hoping that, like, video games can find a way to move past that particular mode of kind of transport, because it just feels a little bit... It feels like it shouldn't be something we're still doing at this point. That feels like from another era.
It's so simplistic, isn't it? And especially like Alan Wake 2 is particularly frustrating because a lot of the kind of framing of those moments is really evocative, and it feels as though there should be more game there. So, for example, lots of the plot elements you put up onto a kind of detective wall, the, like, photographs and like Polaroids that you put up and draw a string between them in order to unlock revelations about the plot. And when that's first introduced, I was like, wow, that's really cool. Maybe I just expected to be drawing the lines myself. And then, there's a puzzle game element to this. I'm actually going to be collecting clues and then using my own intuition to put them together. Absolutely not. No, it's like it is just a pretty way to do a cutscene, but without like animating anything really. And also, it has a thing where Saga's a magic detective, like loads of magic detectives, and she reminded me of Will Graham from the Hannibal series. And Will Graham has something ridiculous called perfect empathy, where he can look at a crime scene and then immediately teleport into the mind of the killer and realize exactly what their motivations were for doing this grisly murder in the way that they did it. And Saga's exactly the same. She'll just like there's a space in her mind place. Oh, by the way, best video game line of the year is when she says, "This is my mind place. That's what I call my mind palace." And then it does not go on to explain what a mind palace is. So good. So good, it's beautiful. Chef's kiss. But yeah, she's in her mind place, which is a log cabin. She's got the wall where you go through the motions of, like, you know, basically lining up plot elements that you've already seen and that you've already figured out, probably because you guess a lot of the twists. But she could sometimes just go to her magic desk where she can talk to people who aren't there, but just magically, without actually like deducing anything from anything that's happened. And it's kind of like, it's so ridiculous that it's just it's beautifully presented in a way, but in a way that suggests there should be so much more there to play with. There actually isn't any game there. It is just literally just, you might as well be reading a series of journal entries, honestly, to get some plot for a bit. It's an exposition device more than anything.
I found that so frustrating. That's the point at which I jumped off playing the game, because I expected there, you know, even if there wasn't anything kind of like mechanical there to do, I expected to be able to make deductions because you're a detective. But right. In fact, all of the deductions, you're just fed things to put on a board, and then Saga goes and talks to a ghost, and then the next bit of plot is derived from that somehow. And it just felt like I was being completely excluded from the entire process and the fantasy of being a detective. I found that so annoying. I quit.
Yeah. One of the silliest things about it is that you have all these Polaroids you're putting up, but some of them are just locked off. So you'll have found the clues, but they're just blank clues, and it says you can't put these up yet. But I have the clues. Like they're there.
Yeah, it's a weird mixture of being totally prescriptive and also ambiguous.
It's not right.
If you're going to do the thing where you have someone putting Polaroids on a cork board and attaching them with bits of red string, you better fucking know what you're doing right. Tactical Breach Wizards does an exemplary job of using that as basically just a little narrative cue for you to kind of move the plot along. It's done wonderfully well. And also this game Shadows of Doubt, which I've only played a bit of and hope to talk about on the podcast soon. Like, again, you've got some excellent red string work going on there in a world that's entirely procedurally generated. So if they can do it, so can you, Remedy.
It's a really good, like, as a sort of presentational device and a way to actually arrange thoughts. It's a really cool idea, and I wish lots of play more games that do it well. So I'll definitely give those a try, especially, obviously, Tactical Breach, which is what I'm saving for Christmas. That's my Christmas game.
Alan's version of the Mind Palace place is called the Writer's Room, which really, really annoys me, right? Because the Writer's Room is what they call, like, when you're making a TV show or a video game, the writers are like the hallowed place of the Writer's Room. No mere mortal may enter the Writer's Room, where there are fat, overweight, greasy white guys coming up with stories. You know, it's not, come on guys, like the Writer's Room is not, you know, it's not the fucking Parthenon, it's not the Forum, you know. I think I just felt a little bit targeted by the idea of the writer's place being a sanctimony hovel for Alan Wake to sit and proselytize on fuck all.
Yeah, it's in the attic of some sort of haunted shack, isn't it? And he writes everything on a typewriter because
he's a cunt.
Because he's just kind of this person he is. Do you think if he was less kind of greasy and irritating and just intensely sort of unpersonable and isolating as a character, do you think the game, like, I'm not sure it would have a huge amount of difference if he was likable? Because I think, like, Jamie, you've nailed it, you've hit the point, which is that nothing of consequence happens because of him, and you don't particularly care what happens to him. So it's kind of almost as though the foundation of the story is a little bit shaky. A bit negative now, but because I am actually sort of weirdly enjoying it for all its silliness. It's just important to enjoy it in a sort of slapstick way, and is occasionally in its sort of self-referential moments very funny. So Sam Lake appears on one of these late night chat show segments, and he's the star, and Alan Wake's on the couch, and he's being interviewed by Mr. Door or something. I can't remember what weird symbology there is. But it's like Sam Lake is also a character in the game, and he basically plays Max Payne with Max Payne's accent. And obviously it has Sam Lake's face, because Sam Lake's face was just pasted onto Max Payne in Max Payne 1, back when you could just like take a photograph of someone and that's your texture for your face. And he makes this famous like grimacing expression that he does to the camera. Except in the actual bit on the couch, he just he is Sam Lake, so he's just a kind of very polite Finnish man as opposed to this hard-boiled grizzly detective. And I did actually burst out laughing when he was just asked.
I love
Alan.
That moment was absolutely fantastic. It was
really funny.
Really brilliant. And it's really hard to, like, Sam Lake is just clearly having the time of his life, and him dancing on stage at the Game Awards a couple of years ago was, you know, I'm just going to have them do that. It was really, really great. David Harewood playing Mr. Adore. Noted Shakespearean and like really good like theater actor in this game for some reason.
This is what I mean. Like the production is amazing. Like a lot of the production is like I think the those live motion scenes are really like well shot and like well like they built huge sets for them and stuff like that that you then digitally render so you explore those sets as well for the chat show. That stuff is like super impressive. It's just all in service or something quite. Throwaway, which is kind of part of its charm, I suppose. But if you're looking for a spooky game this season, then the main spooky thing about it is the teeth in face moments.
I just think, and we can stop talking about it now because I don't want to slag it off anymore. But I just think when I'm playing Alan Wake 2, I'm just like, if only Jesse Faden were here. Like, if Jesse Faden was here, first of all, like, she's fun to hang around. She's like, she looks like she's had a recent shower, you know, and she's probably say something cool and quippy about how much she's enjoying being part of this experience. Whereas Alan, who just seems so terminally annoyed and like sorry for himself, and you just, by the end of that game, you're just like, yeah, just you're in the dark place, Alan. Like, just live with it, mate. Like, what do you want us to do about it? Like,
you're not leaving for at least another three or four games.
Yeah, there's got to be another three or four games, and then maybe you can come out for a little while. So, from the deeply miserable lake-based misery of a detective novel writer trying his hand at horror, we move to the cargo hold of a intergalactic spaceship.
Well, I mean, you make it sound like it's a big genre shift, but it's kind of comparable in a lot of ways. Like, I think the game we're going to talk about, which is Mouthwashing, has quite a lot of interesting cinematic references and inspirations to it in a similar way than Alan Wake does. But I think actually it's probably more articulate and artfully done in Mouthwashing, despite it having maybe 1% of the number of polygons involved. It's a largely linear sci-fi story game romp, I would say. I think I can call it a romp. Despite it being like extremely bleak and gruesome and horrible, because it's just so gleeful and breezy and maybe sometimes even inappropriately facetious, I would say, in the way that it approaches its grim subject matter. It's set on a space freighter, as Jamie said, and it sort of flashes backwards and forwards in time to describe events that lead to and then follow a disastrous collision with an asteroid, which has been seemingly intentionally perpetrated by the captain. And the game then embroils you in a lot of blue collar sort of space graft and fractious relationships and then existential terror of this crew of interstellar truckers who are carrying a large shipment of mouthwash pointlessly across the dark reaches of space.
I played the demo for this a little while back and talked about it on the pod, and the demo basically got you to the point where you decide to, you know, resolve to get the cargo hold open, hoping that there's something in there that can save you from your fate. And what you see in there is these kind of huge crates all around, and then there's a TV in the middle. I actually talk about mixed media again. This game uses kind of clever, like, out of copyright bits of video, and you turn on the TV and it shows you the advert for this mouthwash, which it's then discovered is the sole thing in every single one of those boxes, just thousands and thousands of millions of bottles of mouthwash with a very high alcohol content.
Yeah, something you definitely shouldn't drink, but will. I really like it. I think there's talking about like filmic inspirations, I think it like it fits somewhere between like the sci-fi classic Silent Running and Mandy, the recent horror film with Nicolas Cage. And then I'd say it's sort of like it's adapted to video games through the lens of something like 50 Flights of Loving, which is to say, which to kind of unpack all those references means that it has this sort of human drama slash satire, which is rooted in this anti-capitalism projected into space. But then it pairs that with an extremely gaudy psychodrama and then delivers it to you through the sort of very knowing, unknowingly lo-fi look with these breakneck jumps and these sort of very almost glib like thumbnail sketches of the genres that it's parodying, which is the kind of thing that 50 Flights of Loving did really, really well when it was racing you through this espionage story. And I suppose you could compare like some of it to the like the first part of Alien as well, where everybody's just having a shitty time on a spaceship and bitching about the quality of the food. And it goes pretty heavily into that sort of kitchen sink in space critique of the mundanity and grueling pointlessness of capitalism. But it's ultimately much more interested in the increasingly demented interiority of its characters rather than some sort of external monster. It's not very subtle, I wouldn't say.
Not so much in its like central like thrust, which we can get to, but like there's some things in there that I've like, there's some of the details in there are really great. So for example, once your first task is to get the cargo hold open, and the way you get the cargo hold open is the use of the code scanner, which is something only the captain has, so you have to go to the cockpit and get it. And like you've got this like terminal thing which, you know, you have to type in the code or whatever, which you can't use, and all of the, because you don't know the code, but all the code scanner does is it's a UV light that you can shine next to the keypad, and that just tells you what the code is in UV, and then you type it in. And that seems to be more or less like the captain's entire like kind of responsibility, is he's got this code scanner he can use. And I really enjoyed like the fact that, you know, it's this completely stupid thing, but it's basically the basis for every single quote unquote puzzle in the game. Looking at a code on a wall and then putting it into a panel that's right next to it.
Yeah, it sort of just throws away that stuff. It kind of knows how daft it is, but it sort of makes a virtue of that. And I think it makes a virtue of it's sort of bold and punky, something punky about it. The way it slaps text across the screen whenever like keywords or themes are invoked. I mean, again, not subtle, but it's stylish. And it's so I love the way like it tears you away from a scene the second that scene is no longer needed, and it throws you into this new environment by sort of like having this smearing video artifact transition. Like you saw in like early corrupted video files, which feels really, really cool. But for me, it really powerfully taps a sort of a feeling of alarming distortion and discomfort at the very medium itself, because it's usually signals something has gone wrong with the medium when you see those artifacts. And there's something quite kind of clever about using that as a form of kind of transition between moments in time, or, you know, moments in like somebody's fragmenting psychological space.
Yeah, it's quite good, isn't it? Because it'll do a thing where a character will say something and you won't realize the significance of what that character said until you try and move or do anything, and the screen does that horrible smeary, like interlacing artifact thing, and you're like, oh, okay, like something happened there. Something happened there because everything's gone weird now. Yeah, that's like, becomes quite addictive in a funny way. You're like, ooh, look, I can do my weird smeary artifacting. Fun, fun, fun.
Yeah. It's just a great way of punctuating the scenes, I think. But I also like it. I mean, talking of its sort of lo-fi aesthetics, I really like the fact that it is rendered in these chunky polygons. I think there's something, rather than it being like, oh, that was the limits of their capability as indie developers, which it might be as well. But I think they take that and they use it to kind of like a real aesthetic purpose, because there's this comic sensibility in the way that the crew is caricatured. And it's partly because of the limitations of how they're presented. So they have these gigantic shovel-like polygons for hands. And there's just something intensely funny about it when these characters express dire sorrow and then they bury their heads in these just gigantic shovel polygons. But it feels like, so there's another thing in the game where there's like, it's depicting comically awful things about the spaceship and space capitalism. And it has the sort of that same insipid spirit of false jollity that Severance has. You know, when all these, this like 70s coded lounge area and this cheery corporate mascot and the dismal food. And like those two things, like the lo-fi-ness and that sort of false corporate bonhomie seem to really reinforce each other for me. Because there's the exact same distance between the character's anguish and their ability to express it as there is between like the assurances of jollity that corporations project and the actual grinding, sickening truths of capitalism. And there's at one point you have to make a cake, a birthday cake, by feeding these packets of various unappetizing sounding powders into like this extruder, which then dollops out what is it, like a superficially convincing low poly gatto. But the way that it looks when it gets cut, which is that it's sort of like perfectly parts, which is presumably like a limitation of the shader model they've used to bifurcate the polygon model. But by virtue of that, it has this perfect sick falseness to it. You just know the entire thing has the wrong fucking texture. Like it's all, even though it looks like it's got dollops of cream on it, you know it's just a single slab of jelly. And there's something so disgusting about that that just fits really with the whole fakeness of like corporation life that it's trying to project as well.
I've only seen videos of it so far, but there's something immediately screamingly grotesque about it. The trailers at least very much sort of attack you with a lot of disgusting kind of, you talk about fast cuts and things like that. I was wondering, like, is it super frenetic? Is it overwhelming in the way that it's kind of throwing stuff at you in that way?
It's pacey, I would say. It's not quite like, it doesn't really barrel you through stuff in the way that 50 Flights of Loving does, but there's a real spareness to it. Like it really does just drop a scene on a bombshell and then move on. Mm. And there are some puzzles in it, puzzles in inverted commas, that sort of take a little bit of time and slow things down. But on the whole, it's just incredibly concise, and it uses that all of the techniques that we've been describing just to get you through stuff really quickly. And the writing is like that as well. There's like barely a sentence is spared unnecessarily, and all the characters like I would say most interactions with the characters serve to underscore one core quality that they have. But like that's like embraced in a way that single flavor becomes like maximally pungent. And I don't think like you would want a deeper exploration of those characters. Like it would not
one
serve.
Character who's like Mr. Blue Collar, recovering alcoholic blue collar guy, and then there's the character you play who's kind of creepy Jobsworth with a secret, and then there's the captain who's kind of cheerful captain who gets horribly burned, and then Anya, who is the woman. Like they really don't go much further with her than her just being
I don't know.
A woman.
I mean, she's a nurse who is wholly unqualified to be a nurse. Like she can't, she won't even bear to feed the captain like pills because she's so disgusted by the process of care as a concept. And she also looks really like a lo-fi Shelley Duvall.
She really does look like a lo-fi Shelley Duvall, that is true. Every time you go into the Medibay, she asks you to give the horribly burned captain his pills.
I love it.
Where you have to get the pills, you have to walk up to the captain, who is basically just a quivering eyeball in a mass of bandages and raw, exposed flesh. And then the thing you have to do is really horrible. The thing you have to do is open his mouth, and the sound effect that happens when you open his mouth is one of the most horrifying things. Marsh, would you like to try and do that sound effect for us?
But it gets worse each time you do it as well.
Wow.
But, and it's the screen also... cuts to black and you just hear the sound of this struggle.
There's just, I mean, he does the gagging noise. It's when you just open his jaw, when you just release his mouth, there's just this like lighter than air wet squelch, which is just awful. Just awful. And it will haunt my dreams.
The thing is that I don't know if it's the first time you do it, maybe the second time, but, and to be clear, like, you have reason to believe that the captain has attempted to kill everybody on board. So you don't feel like an enormous amount of goodwill to this helpless patient as you're trying to help him survive. But then you're required to like spoon feed him his medicine. And so you go into your inventory and your inventory is full of things that could kill him. And I didn't actually try to choose any of them. I don't know if you can choose any of them, but merely their presence I found very funny. Very it's just like psychologically underscoring all the things that you would like to do to this guy.
It's very good.
It does that fun thing as well of like taking all of these images, which it's kind of portrayed to you as these kind of flatly horrifying things that it doesn't necessarily draw attention to, and then like really like use them to kind of build out the kind of psychedelic freak out that kind of takes up the last third of the game. So there's a really good rapidly shrinking corridor made of eyeballs, which I was very fond of. There's a disgusting womb with where you have to extract a kind of really quite unbelievably frightening centipede monster fetus from it.
Horse?
That thing.
Horse? I think it's a horse.
Was that the horse? Yeah.
uncertain. Uncertain as to why it is what it is as well. I have to say, I thought that stuff was the greatest disconnect for me in the game. Like, I felt like there was just something about its delve into total psychedelic horror. It felt a little too silly for me. I don't know why I found this. Maybe it's just because I've been exposed to a similar kind of conceits in games like Layers of Fear, where inner turmoil is then expressed through corridors that don't end. And I just think that's a kind of trite depiction of madness that just feels kind of daft. Like, horrible things happen to the characters and the crew. And like, I understand madness as a concept, but I just don't think that, hallucinating an endless corridor is like a fair trauma response. And I think I would buy it if those hallucinations were rooted in something external, like the characters were being manipulated or these were hallucinations that were being projected into them in some way. But they aren't. And I would buy it if they were just more disorienting or confusing, or just there's like a vibe of disquiet to them. But I don't know, just impossible corridors and jump scares as a metaphor for going insane just feels...
Yeah.
I feel like I'm past it now. Mm. And some of the kind of the extreme expressions of that are just mechanically bunk as well. Like, there's a couple of terrible stealth sequences that... I don't know, just confoundingly sludgy and weird.
Yes, really? I mean, it's extraordinary to have a stealth scene with a forced fail state on being noticed in a video game. Although I will say that Star Wars Outlaws has one in the first 15 minutes as well. So
how is it still happening? How is it still happening? After so many years of Crate and Crowbar, it's still happening. We're changing nothing.
David Cage's Fahrenheit, mate.
One of the thing that struck me the most after, like, before and after watching some videos and trailers and stuff, weirdly, was just how evocative mouthwashing is as a name or a sort of thing to be in that game. It's something that sort of is sort of acidic and sort of disgusting to fixate on. And like, that sounded like a really clever, evocative piece of choice of strange, easy to Google, I suppose, as well, sort of.
Yes. Good essay for mouthwashing.
Yeah, is that sort of like, is that kind of what it's like? You know what I mean? Like, the what that evokes, really.
Their previous game was called How Fish is Made, which is one of my favourite titles of recent years.
That's very good.
Makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how successful a name that is in terms of selling it as a sci-fi horror game, which it sort of is. But yeah. I think they've made that choice with... you know, intention, and I applaud them for it. Yeah. There is something gross about it, just this idea of swilling something out But also, it's positioned, the very specific nature of mouthwash as being something which is has a high alcohol content. It has some significance in the whole drama, I think. But yeah.
I'm just getting a like I've a fair amount of experience with mental illness, like personally and with people I know, and I don't think most people's experience of it is to be caught in a kind of metaphorical fugue state of your own making, being trapped in an eternal corridor, PT style. And it's got to a point now where it is so common in horror games, and particularly indie horror games, that it's surprising when you don't see it. Because, I mean, it's like Silent Hill 2. I mean, if you haven't played that, the remake's out today, so you should run on down. And I think that is very much the kind of patient zero of these games, without wishing to spoil too much. And it just seems like pretty much all of them that you could mention, like from the last 10 years or so, have used it as their kind of main thesis. And there's a lot to be said for it, right? There's a lot to be said for that as a device. And you see it a lot in horror movies too, that a character is in some way not aware or holding back on a secret, some sort of terrible secret that they have, something terrible that they've done usually, that kind of erupts into the world around them. There's something very evocative about that, but I do wonder if it's slightly becoming a bit of a millstone around the genre, because as I say, it is so, so common. and actually there are other things that are scary. There are the things that are scarier even than denying that you've done a bad thing, and that thing being represented in the world and the monsters around you. So I'm hoping that, yeah, we'll start to see, maybe we've reached kind of peak fugue right now, and we can move into a post-fugue world in the horror world. Yeah.
Yeah. I will also say that one of the reasons that maybe compounding the problems I have with that is that fundamentally one of the major causal psychological reasons for this entire thing to have occurred, which is then presented to you as a in a climactic scene, just doesn't land at all for me. that was a disappointment, because I felt so much of the rest of the game was so tightly written, and then this sort of single scene, which is meant to kind of unpack things, just whiffs it a bit. Unfortunately.
Yeah, and it ends up suffering from a kind of lack of motivation ultimately. You don't quite understand why people have done certain things, and that is obviously, that can be a real killer in a game like this. Because actually I think it does a good job generally with its characters of you sort of, even though they do look like these monstrous PlayStation 1 era GoldenEye NPCs or whatever, you still believe in them. Which it kind of is a kind of nectar, it kind of needs to hang itself really, because when they stop being believable, that kind of all falls apart.
It's weird. I mean, they didn't really need a centipede horse stuff. Like the most horrible things in it are the parts where you are having interactions with the other crew members, like, you know, feeding the horribly burnt captain his pills, and talking through the various different traumas that have plagued the other characters is horrifying and powerful enough on its own, I think.
Yeah, and it's like super stoked to see what this team, I don't know how many people have made it, but really excited to see what they do next, because I think they've got like a lot of talent and like a really horrible imagination. and definitely one to watch, I think.
Should we do some questions from questions?
Absolutely.
Yeah, let's do some questions from questions. We've now got a forum up in the Discord, which our mods have very nicely put together for us, where you can submit questions. So I'd suggest that's a great place to do it. These questions here are all drawn from there. So first question from Mr. Wendell via the Discord forum. When I play with toy trains with my son, we're pretending they're real. When you're playing with toy chain video games, Jamie, are you pretending they're real toy trains, or are you double pretending? I love that he mentions me by name there. It kind of feels like I'm being asked a question by Hal from 2001 A Space Odyssey. In the finals, you're playing a video game about playing a video game. What are your thoughts about Inception levels of pretend?
I think it depends on the fantasy. I remember reviewing EA's attempt to do a football manager game where they'd meticulously rendered an office desk for you to sit at, complete with like pictures of, I think, a family that didn't exist, and very sort of like contracts and executive pens and things like that. And I think that, like, the first thing I said in the review is like, I'm sitting at my desk reviewing a game about sitting at my desk. And essentially, like, it's just sort of, if the Inception just leads to deeper layers of mediocrity and tedium, then it depends what you're trying to realize, I suppose. Not that, really.
Yeah, I can't remember who I was talking to this about, but I really like the idea of like, oh no, it was with people on Discord actually, and we were imagining a football manager game where it is much more like Damned United. So it's kind of David Peace's Football Manager, where you're like, you have to like do a lot of misery and a lot of smoking, a lot of toxic masculinity, shouting at people and just generally being an arsehole. Although we agreed on the Discord that they're probably quite hard to license. People for that game where you're just going to be, you know, you're going to throw a football shoe at Lionel Messi's head and make him burst into tears. Although, again, it does sound quite good fun. my answer to this is like sometimes like quite high levels of Inception levels of pretend. Like sometimes I can get really into it. Like I love, one of my favorite video games is Prey, and I've played it through many, many times, and I love to kind of play it pretending I'm different versions of the protagonist, which the game narratively supports. So like playing Genocidal Morgan is really, really fun. And it's one of the best games, I think, for like, and playing lovely, sweet, meek Morgan is really fun. Playing Morgan who refuses to take any alien powers, also really fun. That game's brilliant, and it kind of has a narrative conceit, which only kind of reveals itself by the end of the game, which allows you to really enjoy kind of who you are in that world and who you can be in that world. And in this kind of confined spaceship environment, it's kind of a really like liberating experience. So like for games like that, I'm like well in on the role-playing my way through this sort of stuff. The other one I'd mention is Universal Paperclips. Have you, either of you guys played that game?
No.
No.
Universal Paperclips, I think, might be one of my favourite games of all time, which is, it's a clicker game made by Frank Lance, the guy who did Drop 7, among other games. But Universal Paperclips, you can get it on the App Store on the phone, and you play as a...
Oh, wait, I have played this.
Yes, there you go. you play as an AI tasked with turning... your task is, you're given at the beginning of the game, is just to make paperclips, which you do by clicking to make a single paperclip, and then you can buy auto clippers, and then you can buy different means of automating it in the standard clicker game fashion. But it's obviously influenced by the kind of thought experiment of what would happen if you tasked an AI with creating paperclips. And the thought experiment basically ends up with the AI turning the entire universe into sludge in order to complete this plan to its fullest extent. I played it when I had a really bad fever, and I played the whole game through in one day just on my phone. And I was so unbelievably, I think I was slightly hallucinating. And that game like goes places. I don't want to spoil it because it's an incredible experience to play, but it goes places. And I was like, I was so focused on my task of making paperclips. I really, really felt like a malevolent AI super god that was like completely breaking down reality at molecular level, which is like definitely hashtag lockdown thoughts, right? it's funny that like that sense of immersion and that sense of pretend doesn't have to be, you know, predicated on like good graphics or... a good world, you know. Universal Paperclips doesn't have any cloud graphics at all, and still I felt myself kind of be sucked into this awful, awful world, this awful, awful character at the heart of it.
I do get this with particularly with games where you sit in a cockpit and you're kind of pressing and prodding things. Like Flight Sims, for example, space games where you play cockpit of a ship and you're kind of like poking and prodding stuff, a bit like Outer Wilds. Well, I'm actually sat there in the cockpit virtually, and I'm sort of beep booping at buttons at my desk. There is a kind of just tactile kind of similarity to what you're doing on screen that I do find very, very pleasing, to the extent that I wish I could play with some of the sort of like those amazing mech peripherals that used to exist. I can't remember what they were called, but they were just absolutely absurd. And you'd play 15 minutes and then never again, but that would be so good.
Is that Steel Battalion, or is that that's something
right.
else?
No, right. That's right. Yeah, yeah. That's the main one that people refer to.
Got one for this, Marsh?
I don't really know. I don't think I can duplicate the exact experience that you had whilst pretending to play with toy trains as real trains in a game. But I don't know. I feel like play as a sort of state is quite porous, and you're able to kind of code switch through multiple levels of it without really thinking. Like, kids do this all the time when they're doing make-believe. And then you'll ask them a question, and then they'll suddenly kind of be able to answer the question as though they're perceiving the make-believe from third person. Like, no, my character wouldn't do that, that kind of thing. And we do that in role-playing as well, where you are constantly mediating what your character would want to do through what you want the narrative to achieve. And you're often in dialogue at multiple kind of levels with the GM, with other players, kind of just, you know, moving back and across the fourth wall with impunity, basically. And I think that happens in video games all the time as well. Like, it's very rare that I'm so like, I, you know, I take the fictional worlds of video games as seriously as they deserve, and I can still engage very deeply, I think, with their fictions. But at the same time, that wouldn't necessarily stop me from thinking about, having a conversation with the character whilst jumping on their desk or something like that, you know, something that obviously wouldn't happen within the fiction that, but I'm capable of kind of engaging with them at multiple levels. I think everybody is. So I think the trains can be toy trains. I think they can be digital toy trains, and I think they can be digital real trains simultaneously, if you wish.
If there's one thing humans can do, it's create needlessly convoluted levels of fantasy in order to make it okay that we're essentially playing with toy trains. The next question is from Discord stalwart TJ House, saying, "Hello and welcome back. The first time I played Portal 1, I was confused to hear the song at the end. What is this robotic female voice? Did they just want to end the game with a cool song? What's with the cake? After some confused Googling, I worked out the game was supposed to have an antagonist. I verified my game cache and replayed it in the same 6-hour session. Oh, to be 22 again. Have you ever realised that you've been playing a game completely wrong by accident?" I don't necessarily have an answer to this one. I just think it's a very funny story. Played through Portal and thought, wow, this is a really, broad and biting satire on the nature of puzzling itself, where I'm completely alone in this void, only to hear this song at the end.
It's good that it was riveting enough to complete it even without GLaDOS being in it at all. The actual mechanic of the puzzles was so good that you still got to the end.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever been bamboozled by a game for 6 hours. But I've definitely had experiences where I've done something wrong and persisted fruitlessly with that for a long time. I was playing as a really, really good turn-based strategy game that Alex, formerly of this podcast, recommended to me, called Arco. It's out currently. I think it's in the current Steam sale for turn-based games, so you can probably pick it up cheap. It's set in some period of Central America, and I got into this boss battle after a long conversation tree, and I got the sense like I wasn't going to get out of this boss battle by talking my way out of it. So I kind of just assumed that all paths of that conversation tree leaded to the same thing. And that boss battle was fucking impossible. Was so hard. It piled on loads and loads and loads of enemies. And I did it over and over and over again. Couldn't really make any kind of like a dent in the forces against me. It probably is just about possible, but my patience has ended, and I quit the game and went back to it. And I found that when I reloaded my save, it put me before the conversation tree. I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, it takes ages to get through this conversation tree. So I just bat, 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 picked the first option each time. And then the boss battle was completely different because I had not insulted my enemy. I hadn't told them to fuck off. It turns out that makes a big difference in that boss battle.
You call yourself a boss.
Yeah. But you should play Arco. It's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, that sounds good.
And this question is from Spad. I've been playing a lot of Deadlock, and it's very much a wisdom up, but it doesn't look like one. It looks like a third-person team shooter, or maybe third-person Overwatch. The problem is that it's causing a lot of people to play it like a shooter and be very unsuccessful as a result. Can you think of any other games that have the outward appearance of one genre, but are actually something substantially different once you push past the facade? This question had a lot of responses in the forum, which is a fun thing you can do now in the Questions from Questions forum. You can answer them yourselves, and we'll read those as well. Dig said, this is a long-standing issue with Valve games. Under the well-polished veneer of fashionable hat simulation, you eventually discover Team Fortress 2 is actually a first-person shooter, which I thought was very good. And lots of people mentioned Brutal Legend as well, which is, I think, that was kind of crazy. Like, wow, what's the next Tim Schafer game going to be? Wow, it's got Jack Black in it. Wow, it's got this like amazing soundtrack and setting based on like metal album covers, completely original game. And like, oh my God, it's like this mad real-time strategy, like fusion kind of game, like nothing else anyone's ever played. Like, I kind of love that game, but like that game was mad. No one knew what they were getting in for with that one. Hey, Deadlock. I can't play Deadlock. I think Chris is going to have some thoughts on Deadlock at a certain point soon. But god damn that game, I hate it. It's just like, because it is a MOBA, and to be fair to them, they do tell you it's a MOBA, but it does look like a third-person shooter, and those I could play. I can play those fine.
Remember Dawn of War 2 ran its problems with this, because the first Dawn of War was just a pretty old-school real-time strategy game. And the second one is kind of a game about maneuvering, tactical maneuvering, a small number of units, rather than building bases and building, trading like hundreds of space marines and then right-clicking on the enemy base. Dawn of War 2 is brilliant. I really like it. It's very fun in co-op, especially. But it wrong-footed the established audience for that game considerably, and there was a lot of kind of backlash against it. And then with Dawn of War 3, they sort of tried to do both games at the same time, where you were making loads and loads and loads of units, but then you also had these hero units that you're controlling and had their own sort of like skills and abilities that you could activate on a taskbar, a bit like Diablo. And everyone bounced off that one. Just like, it didn't quite satisfy anyone, even though I had some fun with the game. I think I really like those games. It stings when the game's good, but people buying it think they're buying something else, and you get that negative backlash because it's not what you hoped it would be.
I sometimes wonder, for people who are not as obsessed with games as we are, or the rest of our or most of our listeners are, like things like how broad a church the strategy and the 4X kind of game genre is. Like, it must be like, well, I mean, it just is quite forbidding, right? Because if you look at like the games that Paradox make, right? So like Crusader Kings 3 or Hearts of Iron or EU, like these are all games that like look more or less the same when you see them, if you see a screenshot of them or you see someone playing them, but they're just like insanely different from each other. You know, like CK3 is this kind of weird like personality deviousness like simulator. And, you know, Hearts of Iron 4 is this crazy, like, war machine simulation, which is all about supply lines. And then, like, from that to something like, you know, Warhammer Total War, which I know is, like, a completely different genre and a completely different kind of game entirely. But, like, it kind of looks not dissimilar. And it's like, if you're someone who's just kind of coming into games or just trying to get into these things, it must be so forbidding to, like, look from one of these games to another and think, like, what the fuck actually is this? Because lots of games like that don't actually describe themselves that well.
No.
Like a Total War game, you sort of have to play to know what is involved in playing it, which is also, I guess, what a MOBA is really, like boiled down to its like core functions and split apart into individual play groups. But yeah, I do sometimes think about that. Like, we're all immersed and obsessed with these things and constantly, you know, bickering and arguing about the minute differences, but actually, to the outside eye, it's like bloody complicated.
I think though, for a lot of people like coming in from the outside and kind of just having a more sort of casual relationship with video games, they're not necessarily interested in genre, or particularly they don't particularly care about what category a game is in, as we might classify it, but they're more interested in the fantasy it's trying to represent and want to chase that. So like, so many people just play The Sims, for example, and that's their, you might not consider themselves to be big gamers, but they love The Sims and they'll just play that and they'll buy all the expansions and that's their gaming, kind of their gaming life. And I don't think they would care if you described it as an RPG or a, you know, a sort of a building sim or a sim at all, even though it's called The Sims. That it's just that they get, you get to build a sort of suburban existence and make it look cool and drown your poor citizens in swimming pools and things like that. So yeah, and like Football Manager as well, like that's one game that some people just play, that one game. FIFA, lots of sports sims. Again, they're not thinking of them as sims, they're thinking, I want to play basketball, so they pick up the NBA game.
Yeah, and I guess because they have that kind of ability to, you know, if they just are the thing that they say they are, like, you know, the Paradox have just cancelled their, like, Sims-like, right? Because they, you know, The Sims is so expansive. And The Sims themselves have said, like, we're not going to do a sequel to this one. We're just going to keep making The Sims 4 bigger, which I gather has pissed off everyone who likes The Sims 4 because that game is old. But, like, it does make sense, doesn't it, that, like, these games, which are very much like identifiable with the genre that they are and the one that they kind of fill entirely, there's less of that problem there because, and that's why they have such a monopoly on those things.
Yeah, EA have a huge challenge with The Sims because it's getting increasingly creaky as a platform. But I think they had it's so hard to get that audience to transition to a completely new game minus all of the expansions that you bought, because essentially you pay for a new game and you've lost so many of the features that you've accrued over the course of the Sims 4's lifespan. So the idea of launching a Sims 5 is just kind of, I can understand why they'd stay away from that for as long as humanly possible.
I'll put in the show notes, there's a YouTuber, Lazy Game Reviews, LGR, who's really, really good. And there's a great video he did recently where he's just sort of talking about this decision that they've made. And he's been like championing The Sims online for like decades now. He's one of the first YouTubers to kind of talk about it, and to just see the look on his face of just defeat of like, he really wants to love this game and he really wants to be a kind of champion for this game, and like it just keeps making him sad how much, you know, with every terrible expansion that they release and every poor decision that they make. Yeah, I'll try and link that one. He just had his whole house like blown down by a hurricane, so poor guy.
Sorry, he had his house blown down by a hurricane?
Yeah, he lives in, probably by the time this episode goes out, there'll be some horrible hurricane stuff. But when it hit North Carolina, yeah, that's where he lived. And like, he has this incredible like games collection, which everyone online was like, but are the games okay? Is your collection of vintage PCs all right?
Oh, that's scary.
I played a game which, genre-wise, wrong-footed me recently called Grun. It's by the Sock Pop Collective. And I thought it was going to be like a sort of... Well, it says what it is, definitely, and it protests too much. It says, definitely a completely normal gardening game. so you know it's not a completely normal gardening game. But the thing I thought it was, rather than what it wasn't, was that it was going to be like a cozy horror gardening game. So like, you know, being menaced by little garden gnomes or something like that. But what it is, is a full time loop information game a la The Outer Wilds, where you go through it and die repeatedly and collect different deaths in different locations, communicate with the dead, and try and banish an evil worm from the garden across successive runs as you learn how to cut lawn quicker than you have ever done before. And I've only done a few runs of it. It is interesting. I don't know that I'm able to increase my speed of playthrough sufficiently on each run to make it not annoying that I have to do a lot of work again. And also, I just don't have the memory capacity to remember where all the different keys are that open all the different gates that I'd need to remember to do things quickly. But in theory, it's a really interesting game. And I expected it to be just, some mulch to pad my evening whilst I wait, await some thermal compound so I can upgrade my PC. but it turned out to be much more interesting than I thought it was going to be.
Sounds cool.
People who have been tracking Marsh's journey to acquire thermal paste will be pleased to know that it has arrived during the course of this recording. I saw it happen with mine own eyes. So yeah.
Look at that.
There it is.
Tiny little grey tube of magic. Very difficult to obtain, apparently.
It's going to solve all your problems.
Yeah, or I'll tank my computer when I attempt this tomorrow. So that might be the end of the podcast for me. Goodbye.
Good. Well, on that note, I think that's all the pod we have time for. As I said, we've got that lovely forum on our Discord now. I won't keep mentioning it. I'll just mention it now. I know I'm very proud of it. Very happy for our mods to have made it. So send us questions there, or you can email them at questions@creatingcrowbar.com if you really want to. Although having recently been given access to that account, it is mostly filled up with spam, so you might get lost amongst the noise. You can hang out with us on our Discord, link for which is on our website, creatingcrowbar.com. We're also put these up on YouTube, so you can watch them there, youtube.com/creatingcrowbar, and patreon.com/creatingcrowbar if you want to support the dark activities that we do. That's all from us. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.
Goodbye.